your father's house the afternoon of the rainstorm? Her dark, luminous eyes searched his soul. You must not say such things, Daniel. The danger. He placed a finger on her lips. What danger? Who cares? All they can do is kill me. Lucita kissed his fingertip. But if you die, Amado, I will die too. No. You're young, too young to die. Daniel, I would not live without you. I adore you, my darling Yankee. He kissed her again and felt her body arching against his. Weightlessly, they floated, intertwining, gliding through the silent emptiness. We can never let them know of our love, Lucita warned. Not let them know? Dan laughed. I want to tell the whole world. I want to write it across the sky in letters of fire. No, no, she begged, frightened. They will try to take me away from you. Never. We'll run away. Where would you like to live? New Zealand? Tahiti? Shall I buy the Taj Mahal for you and make it your palace? Or build a new world all our own, far out in space where no one can ever reach us? But she was very serious. Daniel, we cannot run away. I will not be the cause of your giving up everything you have worked so hard to build. The only thing I want is your love, he told her. Nothing else matters. You have my love, dearest one. You have all my love. Her vibrant young body was flawless, irresistible. She stretched languidly as he stroked every curve of her. Slowly their bodies revolved around each other as their passion rose, skin glistening in the heat of their desire, endlessly floating in the sensuous, weightless freedom from all restraints. They were alone in their own universe. Nothing else existed. No world, no stars, neither night nor day. Only each other. The electric thrill of flesh on flesh, the whispered moans of delight, the musky scent of arousal climbing to its farthest peak. His mouth on her nipples, her hands sliding along his flanks. He gripped her buttocks and she threw her head back, keening as he entered her hard and demanding in one insistent thrust, and they heaved and writhed together as her warmth enveloped him, and he held her thrashing, sobbing, shouting her pleasure and pain and mad, wild desire. Dan's eyes snapped open. For an instant, he thought he was back on the construction gang with the burly old Japanese foreman prodding him to get out of the bunk. But as he focused his sleep-blurred eyes, he saw that it was a stocky Russian captain in the red-trimmed uniform of the Strategic Rocket Corps prodding his middle through the sheet with the muzzle of a stubby pistol. Behind him stood two Russian soldiers holding ugly, snub-nosed machine guns. They fired flechette darts, Dan recognized. The darts would not penetrate the fragile skin of the space station's hull, but they had more than enough power to puncture the thin sheet covering Dan's naked body and the living skin beneath it. Daniel Hamilton Randolph, said the captain, in impeccable Midwestern American, I arrest you for piracy in the name of the Presidium of the Soviet Union and by order of Vasily Malik, chairman of the Soviet Combined Space Forces. Chapter 3. In Paris, it was drizzling again. Willem Kvistikart sipped at his aperitif, savoring the golden warming glow of the Pernod as he watched the gray, wet evening slip inexorably into the darkness of night. Once they called this the City of Lights, he said to his young aide, almost sighing at the memory. He was a tall, raw-boned man, vigorously active, although well into his 70s. His thick hair and mustache still showed traces of gold among the silver. His voice was deep and strong. His big knuckled hands dwarfed the glass he was holding. The lights are on again, replied the aide. His youthful face looked puzzled. He had the bland, innocent features of a born bureaucrat. Kvistikart knew that the youngster had gone straight from college into government service. Never been in the real world at all, never experienced a day for which he did not have an agenda already prepared, in triplicate. Kvistikart did sigh. It had been a long day, a long week, and now his flight back to Geneva had been delayed several hours. He sat under the awning of the hotel sidewalk cafe and watched the few straggling pedestrians scurrying toward their homes in the cold drizzle. I didn't mean it literally, he told his aide. Oh, sorry. Kvistikart took another sip of the Pernod and felt its warmth spread inside him. But it didn't taste the same. not like the old days. Nothing was the same anymore. When I was your age, he said, Paris was the most exciting place in the world. At this time of the evening, the city was just beginning to come to life. The restaurants, the cars, the women. He shook his head and gestured half-heartedly toward the emptying streets. If the weather were better, it's not the weather. It's not the weather. It's here. Kavistegar tapped two fingers of his right hand against his breast. The heart's gone out of Paris. Out of all Europe. It's all turned gray and dreary. You're tired, the aide murmured sympathetically. Once the sun comes out and you get some fresh air into your lungs, you'll feel differently. Tomorrow you'll be on the ski slopes. You'll feel better then. I'll have to fight my way past Russian tourists, Kavistegar muttered. The aide laughed politely. Then, changing the subject quite deliberately, he said, I thought the conference went rather well, didn't you? The older man lifted his shoulders in a weary shrug. Conferences always go smoothly when all the real work is done before the conference opens. You did a magnificent job. I suppose there's some sincerity in that, Kavistegar thought. After all, his job is secure. He doesn't really have to butter me up. But he leaned across the tiny table and said, The International Astronautical Council is nothing but a rubber stamp for the desires and actions of the Soviet Union. Since I am chairman of the council, that makes me the ink pad for the rubber stamp. You are working for an ink pad. That's not true, the young man blurted, astonished. Kavistegar smiled inwardly, pleased to have penetrated his bland facade. If I'm an ink pad, he thought, what does that make my assistant? The conference resolved several very difficult issues, the aide went on, his voice at least half an octave higher than it had been. The matter of allocating new orbital slots for communication satellites, the question of disseminating geological data from observations made from orbit. Kavistegar waved him to silence. Tell me one issue that was decided in a way that the Russians did not approve. The younger man blinked once, twice. You see? Kavistegar almost laughed. It was the Soviet government which organized the agenda for the meeting. Every item on the agenda was agreed upon before the first session convened. Every issue went the way the Russians wanted it to go. We shuffled a great many papers. We listened to a number of boring speeches. We sat for 4 days and held 16 concurrent sessions. We accomplished a lot, the aide muttered almost sullenly. Kavistegar held up his right hand, the thumb and forefinger hardly a centimeter apart. Not even that much got through that was against the Russians' wishes. Not one iota of disagreement was allowed. They run the IAC. You and I are merely figureheads. The young man shook his head, frowning. Come on, son, admit it. The Russians own outer space. They run things exactly the way they want to. Just as they run all of Europe. For several moments, neither of them said a word. Kavistegar took a long pull on his drink. His aide sipped at his demitasse of coffee and tried to avoid the older man's eyes. The chill was getting to Kavistegar, despite the yellow heat of the Pernod. He pulled his topcoat closer around him and slouched deeper into the rickety chair. They didn't have to fire a shot, you know, he muttered. Once the Americans backed down, they could have had Europe for free. It was the French, the younger man said. They forced the Soviet retaliation. Bah! Do you believe what they told you in school? I was there when it happened. The war? It wasn't a war. It wasn't even a battle. The Americans announced their withdrawal from NATO. On the day it became effective, one hot-headed French submarine captain fired a missile, probably at the United States, if you ask me. Or maybe he was a communist agent provocateur working for the Russians. That thought occurred to me. That's impossible. Kavistegar smiled frostily at the young man's naivete. Was it? The Soviets announced that they have weapons in orbit that can shoot down ballistic missiles. The United States caves in to Soviet demands and quits NATO. One French submarine, part of their pitiful little force de frappe, fires one solitary missile from the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. A Soviet laser beam destroys the missile within 3 minutes of its launch. The Soviets then launch a missile of their own and detonate a small hydrogen bomb in space over Paris. The electromagnetic pulse from that explosion knocks out almost all the electrical power systems and equipment from Iceland to Krakow. No electric lights, cars don't work, heaters don't work, telephones don't work. Most of Europe is plunged into darkness and cold, and panic. People